I'm very pleased to welcome to the studio Ian Murto, who is the only full-time worker at The Crescent. You better explain two things, what I mean by full-time worker and what is The Crescent?
The Crescent is a charity supporting people living with HIV, based in St Albans, founded in 1988, First World AIDS Day. Up until 2010, we had a full complement of staff. We had about eight people at our full strength. Now there is only me as the remaining part-timer after our funding cut in 2010, and I have one part-time assistant. My title, I suppose, project manager, cook, cleaner, gardener, anything you like.
But then you don't actually deliver all the services that you provide the Crescent. Does somebody coming to you have to have HIV?
No. We have people that, in fact, we have some people who are being counselled at the moment who have risk behaviours that put them at risk of acquiring HIV, and we're working with them to prevent that happening. For example, they come to us repeatedly testing, and we know that what they're doing is going to result in an infection, so we try and prevent that.
Physically, the Crescent is a building.
Yes.
In St Albans.
Yes, Russell Avenue.
And therefore, you have certain facilities in place there, and people come to you for advice.
Yeah, advice. We have a daily drop-in service that's open access, so anybody can come in during our opening hours throughout the week. We also have appointments at the weekends. They can come to us for advice. For HIV testing, we can send you a test kit by post and pick up condoms. Anything that could be practically considered connected with HIV or sexually transmitted infections, anything of that nature.
If we go back to before you started, well, you presumably weren't there in 88.
No. Joined shortly after, but 92, I think, was my first venture in.
But if we go back to the start of the Crescent, that was sometime after AIDS had become a public issue.
Yeah, it's when it was at its peak, really, I think. Yeah. It was starting in 82, the first official diagnosis. A group of local residents concerned about care and support for people living with the condition in the area got together and decided to found this group that would provide some sort of respite, some sort of care advice. At that time, there was no treatment. A diagnosis meant, inevitably, for very many, a death sentence. And so it was just helping people arrange their affairs and deal with the inevitable. It was a very horrible time, really.
Presumably you were working with the health services, local health services.
Yes, yeah. The NHS had a facility, actually, in Russell Avenue, where they provided in the community, medical care, and the Crescent was based in Church Crescent around the corner, hence the name, providing the sort of social, emotional and palliative sort of care in the community. In 91, we combined the two services, so they both moved together into Russell Avenue, and as combination therapy started to become available, the effective treatment, the NHS withdrew to the local hospital, leaving the Crescent to run the social care side of things from the Crescent building in Russell Avenue.
So you were seen then as a critical part of the whole service.
Still are in many ways, because although the medication is still very effective, people's understanding and the stigma that's still associated with it is a real problem for very many people we look after. A lot of them don't tell people that they have HIV. They don't even disclose it to their families, so we're the only people that know. So it can be a very isolating condition for them.
And of course, stigma's been with AIDS right from the beginning, hasn't it? This is a great, enormous panic in California or wherever it was, that it was gay community had created something which was going to decimate the world. It was a plague.
Yes, however, it had been around a lot longer than that. I mean, the origins in the Congo and other areas where there have been isolated samples that have identified it going back to the beginning of the 20th century. What used to happen in those instances in those communities was that the infection would spread through the community would die out, but because there was no travel between communities, it would end there, and then until the next outbreak, and then much like Ebola and things were contained before, with the development of road travel and air travel in particular, and missionary work in those areas, it began to spread out because people were moving from one place to another. You've got truck routes with people going through and airports with people leaving, and that's how it ended up in places like San Francisco and the like. And the difference being there is it started to affect people who had access to the press, and they had money and they had influence, and so they could make a noise. And so the first instances where people became aware of the condition were because of these people making a noise about it. Hence, everybody assumed that it was just a gay issue. In fact, one of the first names for it was GRID, which was gay-related immune deficiency. AIDS-related complex was another one, and nobody really understood how it was transmitted, but it seemed just to affect that community. After a while, it became evident that it was getting into other communities, firstly, I think, through blood transfusions, because the blood wasn't screened. As we've seen recently, there was still an issue with haemophiliacs in this country who were badly affected through factor VIII, contaminated factor VIII from the States. It was President Reagan's resistance to the idea that created a lot more hysteria, but that's where its sort of origins have lain. And ever since then, we've worked so hard to undo some of that. What compounded the problem was our Don't Die of Ignorance campaign here in the UK. Very effective, because there was no treatment, so people had to be scared to avoid it, which is all well and good. But things have moved on since then, and we haven't had a similar campaign to update everybody. So most people's reference these days, if they're of a certain age like myself, goes back to the Don't Die of Ignorance campaign. So they still think it's a death sentence, and they still think people will be visibly ill, that once you have it, that's your life's over. We still have people who have been tested who come to us thinking, that's it, game over, how long have I got? That's their sort of response.
And you've got people that now that you're working with who are even older than me, probably.
We have now people in their 70s and they're coming up for their 80s who were diagnosed at the beginning of the epidemic, have been living with it for sort of 25 plus years, 30 years. And it's a strange situation to be in, because when we first were sort of created, it was never imagined that people would be able to live that long. A diagnosis at that time usually meant that, unfortunately, somebody wouldn't live longer than 2 or 3 years. A few managed to work their way through it. How was never something you were able to establish. It just seemed so random. But with the advent of proper treatment in the mid-90s, it really changed things, and people we thought were going to die were suddenly back up and walking and healthy again. Now, treatment is so effective, usually one tablet a day is enough to keep someone in an undetectable state, which means they're uninfectious. They can have children, they can do anything they want, and their life expectancy is no different to anyone else. So that's the sort of reality of it today, but the public's perception is still lagging behind, I think.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because we can all remember the impact of the early days, and it was very visible and it was very well defined. It was young, generally young, gay community. And it's not that at all. I mean, it now has spread right across the whole sexual spectrum.
HIV doesn't discriminate. And the issue is not necessarily someone's sexuality or their ethnic origin, although some people are more likely to acquire HIV just because of the prevalence in their community. So if you're someone coming from sub-Saharan Africa, you will be well aware that HIV is a big problem in your continent. You will know about the risks and the issues. Similarly, gay men, who have been the sort of focus of the epidemic almost from the beginning, know too well all about it. What is lacking is the awareness in the heterosexual community. They seem to think that because a lot of health campaigns are focusing mainly on the at-risk categories, the gay men or the black African, that it doesn't affect them. But HIV infection really is about behaviour. It's not necessarily about your ethnicity or your orientation. A gay man in a monogamous relationship, a black African in a monogamous relationship, are not likely to acquire HIV. But someone who has a different partner on a regular basis, irrespective of their gender, their orientation or their ethnicity, is more likely to acquire it.
And you can have HIV without knowing you've got it. That's
yes.
The trick, isn't it?
Yeah. Sort of median period could be between 7 and 10 years. And in that time, you'll be incredibly infectious and be more likely to be passing it on. We have a huge problem still in this country. In fact, one of the worst countries for it in the sort of developed world, of people being diagnosed with HIV far too late, far beyond when they should really have been on treatment. That causes issues with their ongoing health. You're more likely to die, 10 times more likely to die in the first year following diagnosis if it's late than if you're diagnosed in time. The cost of treating you is incredibly increased, and you're more likely to have been passing the virus on for longer, so there's more people involved in that particular picture. Very often with a late diagnosis, it's not just one person that's diagnosed, it's two or more, because most people acquire it from someone who didn't know they had it in the first place. So it's a growing picture.
You say that people report too late, but if you don't know you've got it,
yes.
What happened? How do you know?
Well, the thing to do is, if you've never tested for HIV, is to test for it, particularly...
If your life is one that's partners
if you've changed partners in the last 10 years, then we would advise testing. If you change partners regularly for whatever reason, then test and make sure they test. The sooner you're diagnosed, the better the outcome is. with effective treatment, there is no reason people could not have a decent lifespan, the same as anybody else. They can have children, they can do any job they wish to do. There isn't any restrictions as there used to be.
And somebody who has HIV and their medication, there's no impact on the child?
No, you can have an HIV-free child. The aim of the medication is to bring the virus down to levels that are undetectable. Unfortunately, we can't eradicate it yet. But when it's undetectable, you are uninfectious. You cannot pass it on. But women are now tested antenatally. And so the chances of us now having a situation where people are born with HIV is almost non-existent. The only time it happens is when there's situations where people haven't engaged with mainstream healthcare, when they've had communities dealing with childbirth within themselves, and they're more likely to be the communities that won't reach out for all sorts of reasons rather than just medical ones.
Does every woman know that she's going to be tested antenatally?
They're asked.
Yeah. Okay.
It's discussed with them. Because if they are found to be positive, then they're given a course of treatment and the baby's given a course of treatment after birth, etc. Natural childbirth is now possible, providing it takes place within a reasonable window. If there's any risk of trauma to the baby during the process, then that's supported in its caesarean section. But generally, natural childbirth is possible too. So.
Okay, interesting. Well, it's transparently clear is that we're talking here about an issue that affects the whole of our community in different
yes.
ways, or potentially, and it's not a narrow, small spectrum that somehow...
No, indeed not. No, it's only when you get involved with it that you realise how far it reaches into our community. In the 25 plus years or so I've been with the Crescent, I've seen quite a bit and come across, there isn't really now much that shocks me or I'm surprised about. The biggest problem is people's assumption that it won't affect them. If we could get across to people that it will infect and affect anybody, and that it's not the death sentence it was, that you can live with it and it's perfectly acceptable, and it's not because you've been bad, naughty or behaved in a certain way, it's you've just been unlucky. It would be better for all of us, because then we would have more people testing. I think the reason that people don't come forward and get tested is not because they're worried about testing or the process itself, it's the fear of what comes after. I mean, most people are used to the test for HIV, the instant test, for example, is just a finger prick. It's like a diabetic blood sugar test, and you get the result in 60 seconds. There and then. So most people can cope with that, I think. The reason I think people don't come forward for testing is they think, well, if I do find out about it and I have got it, then my life's over. And that is the biggest hurdle we've still got to overcome.
Yes, because come back to what you said before, the sooner it's detected,
yeah.
the longer
yeah.
normal life.
The better your health outcomes quality. Are going to be, and the less chance you have of passing it on, because once you're on the treatment and it's brought your levels down to undetectable, then you can't pass it on. So it's better all round, you know, better to know than not.
So there's two, in a sense, I'm sure this is simplifying, there's two aspects to what the Crescent is trying to do. One is to provide a support and counselling service, or
yep.
a range of services. The other is communication, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah, to try and raise awareness. We have a lot of awareness work. We go into schools and universities. We provide placements for university students, particularly in healthcare and social work and those sort of fields, so that we can get the word out and educate another generation so that they come forward with not only the information that they need to avoid acquiring HIV, but also to educate others. So we're sort of sending out a message like a ripple, because that's the only way we're going to overcome it. The more people that can do it, the better.
And when you go into schools, effectively you leave behind a message, but do you leave anything else behind? And I don't necessarily mean something like a leaflet or stick up on the wall or something, but does anybody in that school then say, this is something that's important, we have to carry on with this information? Does it get absorbed into the curriculum?
Yes, generally, if the school are open and accepting of the situation, as we know with SRE, sometimes that's a difficult subject for some schools to tackle. But generally, yes, and we get to go back on a repeated basis and see another generation of students, another class of students. Same with universities. We're sort of regularly at Oakland's dealing with people there to try and raise...
Are you just covering the St Albans district? Is that your remit, or
we have members from as far away as South London. We've even got some who now only by internet means, but they're up in Dumfries. We've got people over Northampton way.
Is that because there simply aren't enough places of the equivalent of the Crescent, or historical
there
reasons?
There is, unfortunately, along with the current theme of austerity, loads of our counterparts are closing because they can't overcome the devastating financial cuts that they've received. We're fortunate in the fact that I've managed to, I think, wring every penny out of every one of my friends to keep the place going. And we've had some wonderful support from the people of St Albans, who've just been fantastic. And without them, we wouldn't be here. And I don't think in many areas they have that much local support. So we are picking up people from other places because there isn't what we offer elsewhere.
Just come to that offer, just to clarify, and we haven't got enough time to go through all the services, but in summary, you've used terms like advice, counselling, guidance. How can you summarise the services that you offer?
Well, it's sort of like a whole person package. If you imagine HIV affects every aspect of your life, then there is every aspect of a Crescent service that helps with whatever that may be it employment, be it your own physical or mental well-being, be it with your relationships, etc., etc. So if you can imagine, it will affect a diagnosis. And it's not only the person living with the condition, it's their family, their friends, and we support them as well as a unit. If they've got other health conditions, we'll aim to help with those, because anything that makes their life more bearable then makes them able to cope with their diagnosis better. So it's really a sort of whole person service. Whatever's wrong, we'll try and help with.
And apart from that aspect of guidance and counselling, and you're dealing with a whole range of different things there, you're going to schools, so that's the education, the communication, universities. What else do you
do? We have social groups, we have peer support, for example. We are an organisation that is run by and for, so the majority of our board are people living with HIV or have been affected by it, either lost somebody to it or know someone living with the condition. And that's the same for our staff too. So therefore we are in a position to work out and design services that will best meet the needs of the people we're seeking to help. People within the organisation, we call them members, not service users, we don't like that term at all, can vote, can become board members, can actually help design the service too. But the main focus is to bring people together so that they can share and support one another. Peer education, peer support is sort of like the core of our operation. So we have social groups. We've just had a lunch. We have a monthly lunch on a Sunday where everybody gets together. And sometimes the conversations have absolutely nothing to do with HIV. It's just people relaxing and being themselves.
Because they feel in a safe environment.
Yes, very often they're going through life I was trying to describe it as a life within a life. They have an outer shell which the world sees. And inside is the real person that doesn't come out until they're in a safe environment. And once they're in that Crescent building, that cover comes off and they can just be, you sort of see them relax and sigh. And then everybody sort of gets together. There's always lots of laughter. It's not a miserable environment by any means. We do have our down periods and people are upset, but everybody pulls together to bring them up. It's just one of the beauties of the place, I think.
And you talk about these various services and all these different things that you do. You can't do it all yourself. You're the only full-time employee. There must be other, I mean, you said volunteer. Everybody else volunteers?
Yeah, we have some volunteers. We have members who are volunteers. Majority of our people work, so the volunteering activity tends to be sort of concentrated on our weekend stuff. Anything that goes on during the week is me, so I'm 24/7. I'm over hopeful that we'll get to a point where we can raise enough money not just to keep our doors open, but to enable us to employ another that will spread the load a little bit, because sometimes it does get a bit hectic.
But if you're providing counselling services and therapies of various sorts, you must use professionals.
Yes, for counselling we have two volunteer counsellors and a paid counsellor, and we have a paid complementary therapist we bring in for the therapies for whether it's side effects of medication or whether they have a comorbidity like arthritis or something like that. Medication does come with sometimes, although increasingly less these days, sometimes initially you have an issue with perhaps nausea or lack of sleep and stuff like that. And things like acupuncture and massage can help with that greatly.
So you can provide a package of around the situation. And is that sort of, you model it to each individual? I mean, each individual situation is different.
Everybody's situation is different. Everybody's life is different. And the way HIV affects them generally can be very different. So we try to assess the person and ask them pertinent questions and try and design a sort of care package that best suits them. Whether that be counselling, whether that be therapies, whether that just be having someone to talk to about it. Or knowing that there is support there, because often it's very lonely. We don't discharge anybody. People leave the Crescent. Sometimes we don't see them for another year or two, maybe five. And then all of a sudden they'll walk through the door because something has occurred, because the condition fluctuates, because situations, people's lives change. People get involved in new relationships. They don't know whether to tell the person straight away or whether to wait a while, etc. All of these things come up.
Can somebody come to you first, as it were, via the internet or via other resources?
Yeah, they can walk in, they can be referred by their GP, they can call us, they can email us. We've got a range of social media options, so there's many places for people to...
And telephone as well, obviously.
And telephone, yes, all the traditional methods.
You're dealing with something which comes out of a background of stigma. You've got people who are cautious about their revelation to their friends and family.
Yeah.
Confidentiality is a big issue?
Yes, incredibly. Trust and confidentiality. I think that's one of the reasons that we've been so successful in helping so many people is we try and maintain some level of continuity. Even when we lost our funding and we lost the staff, the people that are still working with us as volunteers, as therapists and everything are all the same people. The worst thing for someone to do is to get to a situation where they've got to talk about their own story, however it occurred, whatever has happened to them in their life, and then the next week or the next month have to say it again to somebody else, and then again and again. And in the end, they get tired of telling people and they just won't talk. So the fact that they've got someone they know they can come to that knows their background, knows their issues, is a great benefit to them, I think. And that's something that, with the restructuring of many social care environments, needs to be taken into consideration, because nobody likes to go through the trauma of everything over and over again just because, oh, that person that was here last week has now gone and we've got another person in. Stuff.
And there's no good relying upon a record that's brought into a computer.
No. Notes are all very well and good, but they don't create the emotion or convey the seriousness of something. And of course, notes are only as good as the person who's left them.
You said that you've had a lot of support from the local community in terms of fundraising. I guess you need quite a bit of money to keep this going.
Yes. We're fortunate in the fact that we own the building, so we don't have to find rent. But running the operation to a reasonable standard and providing as many of the services as we can usually costs us between £4,000 and £5,000 a month. Now, I've been raising that more or less on my own for 7 years now, and it's incredibly difficult. There is a number of charities that have been very kind to us, and we've been successful with a number of grants, but they're mainly for projects-specific activities, like for counselling, etc. One charity, Hearts Community Foundation, have just helped us with our counselling costs. But for the core running costs, for the gas, the water, the electricity, the insurances and things, that is incredibly difficult to find money for. We were always very, very aware and very grateful for the support of the cathedral too, because each year they provide us with some funding right at the very point we need it. The beginning of the year is always a very low point for us, and that's also when our insurances, our contracts, everything renews, and so you've got big outlay all in one go. And trying to get that funding from an external source is nigh on impossible. Everybody seems to want to fund the outside of the cake, the icing, but not the actual... the base of it, the cake itself, it's very difficult, very, very difficult.
You could do some big bequests.
Yes. Every time I think we've got to the point where we can't go on any longer and that I've used every get-out-of-jail-free card that I might have possessed and rinsed every single friend of mine for every last penny that they could possibly give me, something turns up. So I live in a perpetual state now of hope. I used to get very despondent and think, there isn't really much hope, this is all going to fall apart. But now I've been through that cycle so many times, so I just get, oh, we're here again, okay, just sit tight. There are times when we run critically low on funds and we have to withdraw from what we're doing and just concentrate on our real core activity and just provide a drop-in and an advice service and basic testing services and stuff until something else comes in. And then when the money rolls in again, we then expand and go back to what we're doing. It'd be nice not to do that, but it's the way we have to work. Often you're faced with a choice of which bill do I pay first, but we seem to get through it.
And in a sense, the elephant in the room is the fact that you've had your principal grant withdrawn. I mean, the local authority grant has gone.
Yes, that went in 2010.
And that was a big hit.
Yes. At full strength, we were funded in the region of about £190,000 a year. That went overnight because we were part funded by NHS Hertfordshire and Hertfordshire County Council, and the two were linked. There was a joint commissioning partnership arrangement. So when one stopped, so did the other. We had some reserves, so we managed to function for a while after that, but then because we'd had staff, again because of the continuity thing, we'd had staff that had been with us many years, we had obviously their redundancy issues to deal with. So we tried to do that in as kind and as an appropriate manner as possible, which then left us in a situation where we had but a few pounds, really. And my mother, who was working with me at the time, and I sat there and thought, well, what do we do? Because we still have people coming through the door. We've still got the same number of people we're trying to help. It doesn't seem that they're going to be able to use the replacement service. As part of the process, we had to survey our members to ask them if they wanted to transfer their information to the other charity on the other side of the county. And I think, I can't remember the exact figure, some 97% of those that responded said, no, can you please try and find ways of staying open? The other 3%, I think, already used the other service anyway, so it was of no difference to them whatsoever. Unfortunately, or fortunately at that time, my grandmother had passed. She was a St Albans resident for many years and had left me some money. And we discussed the whole situation because it was all looming around the time that she was unwell. And she'd left me some money. And together, mother and I, we blundered on with that money, paying the basic bills, kept the place going for a couple of years. There was not much money for anything else, including us, until I could sort of get together a reasonable fundraising strategy and had managed to get a few people to come on board and help. And we slowly picked ourselves up from there. So we have limped along in that fashion. And I think last year was just over 80,000 we raised. It works, but it's fingernail biting stuff.
You'd really rather not spend all your time trying to raise money.
Yeah, because that then impacts on the amount of time I've got available to help people.
That's right. So what gets you going on this every day? How do you drive yourself?
Because my partner was positive. My partner didn't survive. I saw how horribly people were treated. I've experienced it firsthand myself. I had an employer insisting that I test just because I volunteered at the Crescent at the time. So I know how awful it can be for people and how that puts you in a situation where you don't know where to turn. Fortunately, I knew better than they did and was able to handle the situation. But if I were living with a condition and had been put in that spot, I think I would be horrified, petrified, and really, because the thing just rolls on. Once one person knows, another person knows, and then the thing gets out of control and you have no way of stopping it. And it can really, it has wrecked people's lives. Perhaps at that time it was the very worst of the epidemic, sort of the late 80s. And people were just ostracised, just even on the suspicion, not even with the knowledge of whether they were HIV positive or not. So that's what got me involved in the first place. And then the cuts that came in 2010, and looking and thinking, well, where are these people going to go? It's not like they can come forward themselves and make themselves known, because by virtue of doing that, they're then disclosing the very thing they were trying to hide, effectively. So someone had to do it. I was always taught, I was brought up to protect those that couldn't protect themselves. And so I've sort of stuck to that, and that's what keeps me going. You get bad days and you get wonderful days when someone sends you a thank you card through the post and you know you've made a real difference, you know. And you can see people coming in with the world's weight on their shoulders, and a few months down the line you can see them, they're lighter, they're lit, and they're moving, they've got their head up again. And that's what keeps you going. There are lots of disappointments, of course, and lots of things that don't go quite as we expected. But on the whole, that's what keeps me going.
Just before we finish, we're talking about the work of the Crescent now, because it's just about coming up to an anniversary for the Crescent and for
World AIDS Day. Yes, World AIDS Day is the 1st of December. We were founded on the 1st of December, the very first World AIDS Day in 1988. So it's our 29th birthday this coming December. It's also National HIV Testing Week from the 19th of November. But yes, HIV and its associated causes will all be in the press around this period. We're going to be down at the City Station waving and trying to give out ribbons to raise awareness. So, important day for us. One day when we can acknowledge not only that the issue still exists, but also remember those that we've lost to it.
Thank you very much, Ian.
My pleasure.
As Ian said, World AIDS Day, the very day on which the Crescent was established back in 1988, will soon be upon us. It's on the 1st of December, as it has been each year since it was first designated by the World Health Organization. And also, of course, this very week, from the 18th of November through to next weekend, is a National HIV Testing Week. Now, you may already have encountered local volunteers at the railway stations or elsewhere playing their part in helping to promote greater awareness of the ongoing issues surrounding HIV and AIDS. If you'd like to have the contact details for the Crescent in St Albans, the address is 19 Russell Avenue, and the telephone number in the daytime is 01727 842532, and the out of hours mobile number is 07904 812500. You can email info at thecrescent.org.uk. And of course, the website is www.thecrescent.org.uk.